As sure as his resurrection, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
He meets us here, not just an empty cross, not just an empty tomb, but the very risen Christ himself, the one who is the resurrection and the life.
We'll send you a CD of this sermon and a sermon on Job for any size gift during the 50 days of Easter. Make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for your support during the Easter season.
Must we die? Are there beings in the cosmos who live forever? Afloat on an endless journey down the river of time.
Little bit of Sunday night's episode, episode 11 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson there is asking some big questions, and in the course of that series episode, engaging in some pretty serious speculation. We're going to be reviewing episode 11 of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey with Dr. Danny Faulkner, as we do every week during the course of the series. Also, talking about the reported discovery of the world's largest dinosaur, at least the bones left over from that dinosaur, here in the next half hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Danny Faulkner is a regular guest. He has a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University and professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. Dr. Faulkner, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's start with these dinosaur bones before we get to our regular review of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. Reported to be the largest ever discovered. They're kind of weighing this creature in at an unbelievable about 10% bigger than the previously biggest discovered dinosaur. Does it change anything in a creationist's worldview?
Not really. I think this stuff is really cool. You've got to keep in mind they didn't find the whole thing. Rarely do you find a whole dinosaur. Later this week here at the Creation Museum, we're going to unveil an Allosaurus exhibit, and it's about 60% complete, which is quite a bit, actually. From what I've read, what they found here was a femur. That's a thigh bone or upper leg bone, and I've seen a picture of someone standing next to it. It's huge. And, from the structure of this thing, the shape and stuff, they can figure out roughly what kind of dinosaur it was. It was a type of apatosaur, the big long neck, long tailed herbivores. And on the basis of the size of this thing, they've extrapolated how big it probably was in totality. So at this point, I don't know if they're going to find much more of it. So definitively nailing down how big it was is not going to happen, but I have no reason to contradict it. We just find an amazing variety of dinosaurs, and the Lord really created some marvelous and wonderful creatures. And Job, I believe 38, talks about this huge creature called a behemoth, which is a lot like an apatosaur. So we used to think of smaller ones in this context, but now maybe Job was and the Lord were talking about something even bigger than we had thought.
Okay, so how do dinosaurs fit? In a very brief way, how do they fit into the creationist time span? We know from all the reports about what they're saying about where these dinosaurs are said to fit according to an evolutionary time span.
Yeah, we would say they were made on day six because they were land creatures. There were flying reptiles, and there were flying if they're swimming reptiles, but dinosaurs proper were land creatures, and so. The Bible's pretty clear about that, that land creatures and man were made on day six. So God made dinosaurs the same day he made people, and people probably had some interaction with them, though they may have lived in different parts of the creation originally. And then dinosaurs perished, as did most everything outside of the ark, at least the land-dwelling creatures. And afterwards, probably the land changed a lot, the plants changed a lot, and certainly the climate did. And dinosaurs just didn't do as well after the flood, and the ones on the ark went out, but weren't so successful as they had been before. So that's the way we would view that in the creation context.
Okay, turning to episode 11 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. What did we hear about? We heard Neil deGrasse Tyson in the opening. They're asking big questions about creatures that may live forever on other worlds, born along on the endless stream of time. What in the world was he talking about?
I think he was talking about, he'd wrapped it up at the end, about the possibility that mankind could endure forever. And he's talked before about extinctions. He talked about civilizations that that died out. He talked about the Akkadian civilization in the Middle East and others, and talked about the Mayans and others. And he was expressing hope that people would get their act together and save the planet and eventually colonize other worlds. And you know, look back on the pale blue dot, which is the planet we came from. Kind of sounded like a religion to me. To me, at the end, he was musing about this marvelous future ahead of all this. So he was talking about the something being eternal or being forever and ever existing in this universe of human beings, not individuals, but our society, our species continuing to exist because we have such smart brains to get us through life.
So what was the, ostensibly, what was the subject of last night's Cosmos, or Sunday night's Cosmos?
Well, you know, he covered a lot of ground. I took a lot of notes, and this one has a lot of things with which I would quibble. The last couple episodes didn't. You know, he started off asking, you know, must we die? And I thought, well, yeah, that's the penalty of sin, death coming through Adam's sin. You might think that's a kind of an affront or a direct reproachment to biblical Christianity, but he was talking about immortality. He talked about the flood, and of course he did it through the lens of the Gilgamesh epics, which he thinks is closer to the original of some story. And he used the ark then as a metaphor. He talked about an ark, life being seeded from one planet to another. He was talking about how we could take off to space like an ark and travel across the cosmos, seeding other planets, colonizing other planets. It was all about preservation of our society and preservation of our species and using our big brains to that advantage. At least that's what I think he was talking about, how if we just simply use our brains properly, in his estimation, we could perpetuate the human race forever and ever.
Okay. Of the science that we had in Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey on Sunday night,
there
how well did
there
it
wasn't
hold up?
Much. There wasn't much. You know, he told a lot of stories. You know, he talked about how life could have developed in a warm pool. That's kind of an outdated idea now. Then he talked about it maybe in a volcanic vent. And he talked about this thing called panspermia, how life could have come from other planets hitchhiking on rocks blasted off the surface of the of other planets, such as Mars or who knows what other planet. He also talked about the reverse taking place, life from this planet taking off from rocks blasted off by meteor impacts and returning to the Earth eventually or going to other planets, and even talked about how some sort of scenario whereby the giant molecular clouds come near the solar system, perturb comets in to smash into the Earth to knock rocks loose that from the Earth that have microbes inside, and inside these molecular clouds, new planets form, and some of those rocks from the Earth might land on these planets and seed microbes from the Earth on other planets. And it struck me when I watched that many people who are, you know, really watching this program looking for scientific answers, they might think, well, this is a you know, very good scientific theory. And my total response to that is, what science is there? There's no data, there's no evidence. What's going on is you have scientists who are telling stories. And just because a scientist tells a story doesn't make it true, doesn't even make it science. I mean, you need evidence, you need data, you need testable results, and you need to experiment, you need to observe. And none of that was part of that. It was all just musing on the part of people. And to me, it's not terribly different from science fiction. You know, the late Isaac Asimov was a prolific science writer, but he was also a science fiction writer. And usually people understood which was which, but I fear the Sunday night's episode, many people watching it might confuse these stories that Tyson was saying, telling us for actual science. And I think that's very sad that people you know, could miss that point, because to me it's not a very subtle point at all. These were just stories.
Why does he have to tell so many stories? Why does he have to say, well, it could have happened this way, or maybe it happened this way, or maybe our best thinking right now suggests that it might have happened that way? I mean, the old story that you said at the beginning of this kind of primordial warm pool where just without any explanation whatsoever, there wasn't life 1 minute and the next minute there is. That one is fairly well discredited, but he's got substitute stories to go along with it.
Oh, sure.
Why does he have to tell so many stories?
Because that's the way so much of science is done anymore. I mean, it's a culture shift, a paradigm shift, if you will, in the way science is being done today. People are putting conjectures together and passing it off as, you know, rigorous scientific ideas because it comes from a scientist. Well, that must be true. And so many scientists, there's a consensus. He used that term in context of something else, but there's this huge consensus that life arose naturally, even though there's good evidence to suggest otherwise. Good science actually argues against that proposition. But you see, if you believe life life just arises spontaneously, you're doing that in spite of the best evidence, because otherwise a creator is just not allowed. You know, you don't want that. And that's the way science is being done so much anymore. More and more stories being told, and it's been a real change. It's okay if you say, well, we think this or it could be that, but he's saying things with a lot of certainty here.
Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. He has a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University. We're reviewing episode 11 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, on this Tuesday afternoon, May the 20th.
Folks attending last year's Making the Case conference absolutely loved the barbecue from Randy's House of Barbecue in Troy in Highland, Illinois. The pork, chicken, ribs, and beef are prepared just like the old days in a pit cooked over hickory, apple, and wild cherry wood. Randy's House of Barbecue, Route 40 and Troy O'Fallon Road in Troy, and at 2649 Northtown Way in Highland. Randy's House of Barbecue, randysbbq.com.
Hey, St. Louis, how would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter sermon and a sermon on the prophet Job preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of two of Todd's sermons.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. 10 more minutes with Dr. Danny Faulkner of Answers in Genesis, reviewing episode 11 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. You said something before the break that I think we should probably put a finer point on, and that is, of many of the stories that Tyson told on Sunday night about origins of life, and this is where the stories all begin to spin from, the origins of life. Have any of them, be it the primordial pool that spontaneously produces life from inanimate matter, or the rocks knocked off of Mars that somehow seed Earth with life, leaving open, of course, the question, where did it come from on Mars in the first place? Do any of these have any scientific evidence in their favor?
No, not at all. I mean, the whole idea of abiogenesis, that is, life from non-living things, is an idea that's been around for thousands of years. And we've had experiments done in the last four centuries. That's how if you study biology, you know, history of biology, all these experiments slam the door shut on those things. Life does not spontaneously arise. We always have life from life. That's the law of biogenesis. So this idea that life somehow arose is quite contrary to good science. And yet they try to claim that we creationists are not talking about science. we have data to support up a lot of experimental results that support our contention that life had to be created. But the people who believe in abiogenesis are believing that in spite of all this overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And, you know, last night he mentioned DNA. He made a comparison to a message there. He called it a message, actually. And he compared it to writing and other types of messages that have to be created by intelligent beings, and they convey information, have to be generated somewhere. But then he asked the question, where did the DNA come from, which is essential for life? And his answer was, we don't know. That's a great mystery. Well, it's a great mystery if you choose to believe things that are contrary to science. Again, science will tell you that something as complicated, a molecule as complicated as DNA, just doesn't arise spontaneously. It has to be generated. And there are many, many very good scientific arguments as to why you can't generate something like DNA, let alone other things that you need for living things.
Well, I found that the most ironic moment there was his comparison to writing and people signing their names and mm-hmm. all of these comparisons he was making. The crucial character was the author. And then when he gets to the writing of DNA, he tries to kind of wiggle out of it and suggest, actually to assert, that the language, the information of DNA has no author whatsoever. It's a book that wrote itself.
Well, you know, it even gets even better. You know, later in the program, he started talking about, he didn't call it this, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you know, looking for radio signals from other planets around other stars. We've been doing this, he said, since 1960, off and on. And my question I always have for people who want to talk about this is, okay, suppose you receive a signal coming from an alien civilization. How will you know that you've indeed received an alien transmission? And the answer is that encoded in that transmission or that signal, you're going to find some indication of a pattern or design behind all of this. And yet there'll be some sort of pattern or behind all of that, indicating design behind all of it, a message, if you will. Yet, when confronted with a message in DNA, they just throw that away and say, well, there's no message here. There's no message here. So, I mean, at one point he doesn't believe that DNA has a message that someone actually has written, but yet he's willfully able to believe that we one day might get an alien transmission and recognize it as such. The two are very contradictory.
I mean,
he's living in two different worlds.
How would he respond? Let's say there's some sort of a signal that's detected that appears to have a pattern or some kind of encoded information in it, some level of information. The producers of Cosmos will herald it. They'll probably start an entirely new TV series to say, we have discovered evidence for life elsewhere in the universe, intelligent life. How would they respond to say, well, so why do you ignore all the complexity and information in the world around you and say it cannot have had a designer or an author or source?
I don't know if there is an answer to that. I've never heard one. I mean, it's flabbergasting how inconsistent that is.
Now, let's explore that one element of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, just a little bit more in the few minutes that are left to us. What I've seen there, at least the movement was, well, we're not so sure about how it happened on Earth. In fact, we can't say it how it happened on Earth. So they push it off to Mars or to an asteroid, saying, well, it must have come from another source and been seeded onto Earth. And when that kind of, well, that seems pretty flimsy. It's not the sexiest story to tell about the origins of life. Then they say, well, look, and this is, in effect, what I heard in the episode of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey. The universe is so vast and so old, life simply has to be out there someplace. Is that the essence of the there's alien life out there riding on the streams of time argument?
That's the essence of the argument. You know, Sir Fred Hoyle made this argument 30 years ago or more. He understood, he was honest about this, he understood that the simple, so-called simple molecules of life, DNA, amino acids, proteins, all of those things were so incredibly complex. He said, what's the probability that they could have assembled themselves by chance? And he got some ridiculously number, like, you know, one chance in like 10 to the 50th power years or something like this could happen, maybe. And on the other hand, he believed that the universe was eternal. And so he thought that no matter how improbable it was, it had to happen somewhere once. And so consequently, he came with this idea of panspermia. And when he suggested this 3 decades ago, he was laughed off the stage. And wouldn't you know it, now it's mainstream. People are seriously talking about it, but they don't have the benefit of having an eternally old universe. He's stuck with 13.8 billion years, which, according to Hoyle, and I think good science again, that's not enough time.
The final assertion of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, is that with our own human intellect, we are going to somehow be able to, if we make the right decisions, avert destruction of all these millions of civilizations that have risen and fallen in the course of the universe's history, a simple assertion there again without any evidence, and that we can actually survive this, but we'll have to make the right decisions. What conclusion is Cosmos driving at in there?
Oh, boy. That gets into politics big time. In order to do this, you're going to need central planning. You're going to need a very centralized government. I think the agenda there is one world government, a Marxist sort of government. He talked about how that these mineral resources are being exploited for profit. I picked that up really quickly. And what he wants to do, I think, is have a world accord on how to solve climate change and how to colonize other planets. And somebody's going to have to run this program. He's going to have to run all of this. And I was struck by the fact that earlier in the show, he had lamented the fact that people like Mussolini and Hitler had motivated and used people, fed them what these were intelligent people who were went along with some very bad things, not realizing what the end was going to be. Well, that's the nature of government, the nature of people. They thrive on power. And if you really want to have a one-world government, you're setting yourself up for a demagogue and a dictator. And that's probably Sunday night's episode is probably the thing that frightened me more than anything in all of that. It's talking about a universalism of everybody in one-world government.
Dr. Danny Faulkner has a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University, and he's a professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. You can find out more about Answers in Genesis at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Faulkner, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
In hour two of Issues Etc., we're going to spend some time with Robert Spencer doing two things. First of all, there's the story of a British imam who has been convicted of multiple terrorism charges, apparently operating out of a London mosque and spearheading, training, coordinating terrorist attacks and the deaths of civilians right there from London. We'll also get an update on the hundreds of young schoolgirls who have been kidnapped and put up for sale by Boko Haram in Nigeria. Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch will be our guest to kick off hour two of Issues Etc. on this Tuesday afternoon, May the 20th, next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion is a congregation firmly grounded in God's grace given in the Word and Sacraments, where we treasure the timeless beauty of the liturgy. Zion is also a vibrant, young, family-friendly congregation where you would be warmly welcomed. Zion is located at 101 South Railway Street in Muscoota, Illinois, and we would love to share God's gifts of grace with you. For more information, please visit our website at zionmuscoota.com.
Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler, pastor, or teacher? Would you like to be equipped to teach more effectively? Join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education July 15th through the 17th at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Find the conference schedule recently posted at ccle.org. Discover the education that is our Lutheran heritage, ccle.org.